Welcome to the Right Take Podcast, news, ideas, and conversations at the intersection of politics and culture, a project of the David Horowitz Freedom Center. I will be your host, Mark Tapson. Greetings and welcome back to the Right Take Podcast. I am your host, Mark Tapson. I call this podcast the intersection of politics and culture because, obviously, it focuses on the ways in which the two are intertwined and influence each other, especially in a time in which the radical left has, ever since the 60s and arguably even before then, turned the personal into the political, and vice versa. Occasionally, or maybe even often, I bring up the issue of religion as well, although I kind of fold that into the word culture. A lot of times I ask my guests, if I think they are religiously inclined, whether they think we in America, and in the Western world generally speaking, are engaged not just in political and cultural conflicts, but in spiritual warfare too. Invariably, they say that we are, and I wholeheartedly agree, which is why I asked the question in the first place. I think if you are a believer, and you look at the issues we are struggling with in the political and cultural spheres, it's very hard not to see that we are engaged in spiritual warfare. In fact, even if you're not a believer, I think you might sense that there seems to be a whole other level of conflict just underneath the surface, or perhaps in the air all around us, that suggests maybe there is a metaphysical dimension to our cultural and political controversies. In fact, like the left says the personal is the political and vice versa, I might say that the personal is the spiritual and vice versa, and the political is the spiritual too. Questions of faith can't be separated from the cultural and political realms. Nor should they be. One of the reasons the Western world is in such a steep decline is precisely because for the last two or three centuries the West has increasingly rejected a sacramental worldview and, as Solzhenitsyn once put it, forgotten God. I spent a big stretch of my adulthood trying to ignore questions of faith and spirituality, never really identifying as an atheist, but living as if I were one, and it was a miserable existence, though I was able to distract myself from that realization or be in denial about it most of the time. Gradually, and I won't go into the long story here about how that process played out, but gradually I came to my senses and not only found my way back to faith, but began to embrace it as a central part of my life and my identity, much more so than ever before. I bring this up because my guest today at The Right Take is the author of a brand new book called Letters to God from a Former Atheist. It's a blisteringly honest story of a man wrestling with God in order to understand and accept God's purpose for his life. He's a friend and a colleague here at the David Horowitz Freedom Center, and I'm very much looking forward to having him on today to talk about this powerful spiritual testament about his own journey from the arrogance of atheism back to his faith, which he has had the courage to publish, especially considering that as a university professor, he is deep in the belly of the beast of secular left-wing ideology, where it takes courage to openly embrace conservatism and faith in the Christian God. I want to talk to him not only about the personal dimension of his spirituality, but about the political and cultural dimensions and implications as well. So stay with us here at the intersection of politics and culture, because you don't want to miss this interview. And don't forget to subscribe to The Right Take so you don't miss any of the other important conversations we are having here. And remember, if you like what you hear, please leave that positive review. Don't touch that dial. My guest today at the intersection of politics and culture is a professor of philosophy at DePaul University, the author of five books, including What Do White Americans Owe Black People? Racial Justice in the Age of Post-Oppression. I interviewed him about that book a few years ago at frontpagemag.com, and it's an absolutely courageous and controversial work, as is his newest book, a brand new book called Letters to God from a Former Atheist, which we are going to dive into today. He's also a Shulman Fellow at the Horowitz Freedom Center and a Front Page Mag contributor, and I think he's one of the boldest, most original thinkers on race and many other topics. His takes on issues are always just fearless. Jason Hill, welcome to the Right Take Podcast.
Thank you for having me, Mark. It's my pleasure.
Oh, my pleasure. So glad to have you. Jason, let's start with your background. You are a mixed-race immigrant. How did you go from growing up in Jamaica to teaching at DePaul?
Well, you know, I had a vocational calling very early on to be a writer. And Jamaica's a very small island. And I finished high school, worked as a journalist, investigative reporter for 2 years at the largest newspaper there. And my brother and I decided we wanted to come to America. And my mother, who just passed about 4 weeks ago, said we were too young. So she packed up my grandmother, and we all came to America in 1985. And I had originally planned to be a screenwriter and a novelist and a poet and get a PhD in philosophy. But we moved to Atlanta, and I did a double major in philosophy and literature, and then subsequently got a scholarship to do my PhD at Purdue University in philosophy. So the journey was one that had been in the making for many, many years, since we were actually in high school. And I felt I had a very strong vocational calling as an intellectual, as a philosopher, and it has never left me. And so we came, and the journey to my path progressed.
And you weren't raised atheist. You were raised Roman Catholic, right? Explain how and when you came to embrace atheism.
Well, yes, I was an altar boy and was raised in a very religious household, a Catholic household. And sometime, I think, in my mid-teens or late teens, I discovered in the works of Ayn Rand and other philosophers, and a turn began in my mind where the concept of God just seemed quite illogical and irrational, and I became an atheist. I mean, the belief just sort of dissipated first and then evaporated totally. Retrospectively, looking back, I realized that, of course, the atheism was sort of forged in the crucibles of anger against God for taking my father away. I mean, he was a schizophrenic who abandoned his family when I was about 12. He announced that he could no longer be my father, and he was repudiating and renouncing his children in order to be the bride of Christ. And I think that was a catalyst that spurred my atheism unconsciously. And it's only recently, since writing the book or during the process of writing the book, that I realized that my attempt to intellectualize my atheism was nonsense, really, that it really was anger directed at God.
Well, your new book, Letters to God from a Former Atheist, is a slim volume, as they say, but it's so packed with powerful, honest, personal revelations and spiritual yearning. But I want to ask you to explain, as you did in your introduction to the book, how you came to express all this in the form of letters to God. I understand that you tried praying for many years, but it wasn't really working for you until one day you heard a voice.
Well, as I was accomplishing many things in life, including getting a PhD, having published my first book a year out of graduate school, you know, finding a really great job, finding love in life, I felt a void. There was an emptiness, and I was driving my truck to Southern Illinois University, which was my first job before I started DePaul. And I was still an atheist. I was wavering between atheism and agnosticism. And I said, God, I don't know if you were there, but why am I feeling this void? And this was back in 1999. And he said, I said, what can I do? Well, if you're there, help me. And he said, and I just heard this like a voice or intuitive message on the order of, what is the talent that I gave you? And I said, writing. And he said, write to me. And I kid you not, I almost wrecked my car. I got to my office and I pummeled out about 50 pages of these letters. And for the next 6 weeks, I was just channeled. I mean, I didn't know what was happening to me. And then the atheism sort of returned, or the agnosticism returned, and I put the book on the shelf for the next 20 years, really. And I continued to realize that atheism was a morally bankrupt position to hold, that it was not working in my life. And it was not an option anymore. So I started adopting certain rituals. I walked with a crucifix in my pocket. I read the Bible. I prayed to this being that I was convinced in some sense wasn't there. But obviously that's not the case because I was still praying to God. And slowly the atheism began to dissipate. And in 2019, I was in Michigan visiting a family. Niles, Michigan, yes. And it was a Good Friday, and I went to the Station of the Cross. I said my prayers. Because at that point, I had a belief in God. It had sort of returned, but I had a problem with the Second Trinity, accepting the divinity of Christ. And I went to the various stations, and I said, open up my heart and have mercy and grace on me. And then that Easter Sunday, I heard a particular kind of sermon where the pastor was saying something like, the bones of Buddha are in his grave because he's there, and the bones of Muhammad are there because he's there, and the bones of Christ are not there because he's risen. And something just pushed me into the prayer, the kneeler. And I said, okay, God, I give my life to you. And I don't really know you fully yet, but I have the rest of my life to acquaint myself and to learn to love you. And that's when this intense journey began. And then my mother got sick in 2023 with cancer, and I went to Jamaica. I was teaching online to take care of her. I heard a strong calling from God saying, you must take care of your mother until she dies. And it was during that process that the spiritual growth accelerated at a rate that I just cannot communicate to your listeners or to you. And I returned to the letters, and I started writing fervently again. And I added many, many, many letters. The book deepened. My relationship to God began to deepen simultaneously or alongside my mother's suffering. And found a good publisher for it. It had been rejected about 100 times because I had tried before finishing the book to find a publisher. But my relationship, God really works in a mysterious way, Mark, because my relationship with God hadn't really cemented itself. So it wasn't time for the book's publication. And at the right time, the right publisher just came along, and I finished the book,
In God's own time, I guess. You write in one letter that we live in a country suffering from an epidemic of loneliness. How can faith and prayer help Americans deal with that epidemic?
Well, I think what happens is that we really do live in a society in which people fill their lives with ephemeral phenomena, whether it's, being addicted to social media, being addicted to sex, being addicted to drugs, even being addicted, as I was, to what I call the tyranny of ambition, to success, driven to achieve and thinking that achievements would be sufficient to fill a void. But we are made in the image of God, and we are connected deeply on a fundamental level to God. And when we separate ourselves from God, there is that loneliness, there is that void. And I cannot communicate to anyone, well, I think I have done a pretty good job in the letters to God of showing that when you align your soul with the Lord, with God, that emptiness, that void dissipates because you're filled with what I call his plenitude, the overbearing abundance of his benevolence and his love. And I'd never felt more fulfilled in those moments and then as a way of life. Continuously know, having returned to God. So I think people, the will to believe is a very, very strong attribute that we have. And the desire to pursue God, because God is always there, but if you extricate yourself from his presence, he's going to seem invisible to you. You're going to be blinded. But once I think if Americans or anyone in the world open up their souls and ask for grace and ask for the discernment, a spirit of discernment, to see God in the multiplicity of ways in which he presents himself to us, in terms of like even service to others. I think this loneliness we can and will dissipate over time, but people have to make that decision that the temporal things of this world, which are fleeting and passing, are really nothing compared to the permanence and the immutability of God, who is not a fleeting phenomenon, is not an impermanent phenomenon. He functions in our lives in the same way that the laws of nature function, with the invariability as they do.
In addition to that epidemic of loneliness, and this may be slightly off topic, but you sort of touched upon this earlier when you talked about your father, but America is also in the grip of a masculinity crisis. In fact, throughout the Western world, I think we're in the grip of a masculinity crisis. It's said that many men, maybe even most men, suffer from an invisible wound called a father wound. And I think I can vouch for that myself. There is a presence in your book, or maybe I should say an absence, that looms large, and that's of your father, a man who, as you mentioned, struggled with mental illness. Can you talk about how faith might be able to help men with this father wound, and how that might contribute to resolving this masculinity crisis?
Yes, of course. I mean, I think even if one has a strong father in one's life, and one is blessed with a good, solid, permanent father, we live in a fallen world. We're fallen creatures, and even the best of fathers are still ones that cannot fulfill all our needs, all our desires. No one human person can do that, or spouses can't do that, or parents can't do that, or best friends can't do that. And so I think operating on the recognition that even in the presence or in the midst of having, or in the presence of an earthly father, I should say, that one is still going to feel disappointed at times. One is still going to feel a certain void. One is still going to feel that the models of masculinity, the model of masculinity on which one is sort of predicating one's identity, is still going to fall short, and that there is one eternal father who is, through his son Christ, I think, is the ideal model of masculinity. And that modeling of our masculinity that involves compassion, that involves strength, that involves humility, benevolence, generosity, a desire to take care of others, a desire to protect others, a desire also to stand firm in the convictions that we hold, and to stand firm in what I really want to say is to have a constant courage within oneself to protect, to leave a legacy, and to take care of others, which is exactly what Christ did. That, I think, is the crisis that we face today, because we do live in a culture, I agree with you, that demonizes masculinity, that calls any show of masculinity toxic, and we live in a culture where men are made to feel ashamed for being men and for exercising the attributes that are properly associated with masculinity. And that has to do with a lot of, I would call them, very evil forces in our society that militate against masculinity and sort of want to neutralize men and neutralize them, force them also into extinction. And I think if we aspire and pin our aspirational identities on an eternal father who has all those attributes, and realize that, again, getting rid of the shame and getting rid of the guilt for exercising and practicing masculinity, sacred masculinity, I call it, in the world, then one is assured of a constant, steady presence and a constant, steady guide. One has an eternal manual, almost, for being a man, for practicing, exercising one's masculinity in the world.
Very well said. As a philosopher and a writer, you extol the virtues in this book of what you call one of God's and humanity's highest attributes, and that is our ability to reason. What do you say to people who argue that faith and reason are incompatible? I mean, people as far back as the Middle Ages had no trouble reconciling faith and reason, but many moderns believe that they're just polar opposites. How do you respond to that?
Well, I think what the reason that there is a belief that faith and reason are incompatible is because people are sort of trying to prove the existence of God, but you can only prove the existence of a thing. And God is not a thing. So I think that the intrusion of science into the realm of proving or disproving, well, you can't prove a negative. Trying to disprove the existence of God presupposes that God is a thing. And I think that we are made in the image of God. We are endowed with a rational faculty. One has to ask, we didn't give ourselves this rational faculty. Where does it come from? It comes from God, who has the attribute of reason, who is the most rational being in existence. And we also every day practice those people who think that they don't have faith. Look, the minute you step outside of your house, the minute you decide to get in your car and drive to anywhere, you're doing so in an act of faith, because there's no guarantee that you're going to get there safely. People need to reflect on their lives and realize that we live lives of faith when we invest in a future, when we have those of us who have children and hope that our children are going to turn out okay. There is no, in the absence of a guarantee, all living is done in faith and hope.
It's a very personal book, but I want to ask you a big picture question about God and the larger culture. When we look around at the West today, a civilization that used to be called Christendom, we see Christianity in decline. We see Christians persecuted more than any other religious group. We see a surging tide of secular progressivism and militant Islam. How is faith, especially one that's rooted in Judeo-Christian values and morality, how is faith crucial to a flourishing civilization? And what can we do to steer back toward a culture of belief?
Well, let me answer the last question, the last part of the question first. If I think about it, I think one of the many reasons that, among others, that we're seeing a decline in Christendom is that we do live in a culture that is predicated on making us feel guilty for having faith, for having a belief in God. That is, we think that we have become so enlightened and so sophisticated that, as Nietzsche says, God is dead and we have murdered him. And he was speaking metaphorically, of course, but I think that in some sense it's to be taken almost literally, that with advanced an increase in leisure, an increase in the quality of life that capitalism has brought to the West, people feel in some sense that they either don't need God or that the belief in God is like a belief in Santa Claus. So I think there have been many forces at work, one of which is secularism, which at the end of the day is ultimately bankrupt, because secularism, among other things, is predicated on the belief that civil liberties and the accoutrements of civilization, as many as they are sufficient to satisfy the soul. When we think about the other religions, when you look at radical Islam, or just look at Islam, not even radicalism, just look at Islam and those who practice that faith, there is an almost implacability and an intransigence in the individuals who are Muslims in relation to their faith. They're not apologists for being Muslims in the way that Christians are often apologists for being Christians. They don't apologize for the values they hold. They don't apologize for organizing their lives in a comprehensive fashion around a set of core beliefs. I have found, actually, when I was what I call an evangelical atheist, that even Christians to whom I addressed were very, very, Mark, very apologetic. They would defer. Even some of the most evangelical among them would retreat in the face of what I would call a logical presentation of the non-existence of God. And I think if your faith is very, very strong, you can use many, many analogies to show that God is very, very real. And Ronald Reagan used an example that I've always found very funny and very interesting. He said, you come to a meal and it's a fabulous banquet and people are sitting there and they're enjoying the meal. And at the end of the meal, would you dare ask the question, is there a chef? So when we look out at the world and we look out at the stylization of the world, at the invariability of the laws of nature, the mechanistic way in which the universe fits together, I would say, is this all coincidence? Is this all chance? Did we all emerge from slush or slime? Or must there be some sort of, not sort of, must there be a creator behind the magnificence? And it is a magnificent world and a magnificent universe in spite of the vulgarity, the coarseness, and all the problems that we're seeing in our world today. It's still a beautiful world because it's still a world that's manufactured by God. It's just that people are tainting it and coarsening it and making it quite ugly. And I will say one other thing that might sound problematic is that I do feel that there are satanic forces at work in the world that is not being countered by powerful prayer. And so, you know, I think the devil runs rampant and the devil is afraid of strong prayer. And in the absence of a strong prayer life, even among Christians, a really, really strong prayer life, we're going to see a lot of mayhem and chaos and disaster and this epidemic of loneliness, among other things, in our world.
As I mentioned before, there's just the book is just packed with so many great moments that it was hard for me to decide which ones to bring up and discuss with you. But here's another one I wanted to ask you about. In one of your letters, and I'm just going to quote you here. You say you're asking God that. Or you're telling God, you need to know his will. You say, I need to feel it pressing against my chest at night. I need it implanted in the neurons of my brain. I need it because, God, I am exhausted by my own will. Not that it has not satisfied me at times, but it has also burdened me. And who knows, it may even have cost me a bit of my humanity. I wanted to ask you about that because I think the human need to kind of assert our own will above all else does put an enormous burden on us. Can you talk about how people can learn to balance God's will with their own?
Well, they certainly have to pray for grace, and they certainly have to, first of all, there has to be a yearning, a hunger in the soul for an alignment with one's will and God's will. I think very often people want to have their cake and eat it too. They want to say, well, I want this in my life, or I desire this and I will this in existence. But I also want to believe in God and to follow God's will, when maybe what God wants for you is not what's best for you. And so the issue of faith comes in on two levels. One is knowing that the application of God's will in your life is for your highest good, a good that you might not be able to understand, but that it is for your highest good. And two, that the greatest feeling, experience of harmony, because a lot of us live very compartmentalized lives, so the feeling of harmony and cohesion in life really does come from being, I would call, a supplicant to God's will. That is prioritizing, truly prioritizing God's will and ensuring that one lives one's life in a manner that is compatible with the will of God, however it manifests itself in one's life. So people are understandably navigating between irreconcilable states of tension. That is, I never pray for money, or I never pray for success. I rarely pray for things. What I always pray for is ability to accept the will of God as it manifests in my life, and to give me a kind of peace and understanding and acceptance, even if it's at odds with my egoic, the will that emanates from my ego, even if it's at odds. So one has to have a desire, real hunger for to know God and to love and trust that the application of God's will in your life, the materialization of God's will in your life, is quite a beautiful thing, even if it results in an outcome that is at odds with your what I call your temporal will. But one really has, because I have suffered so much, I think I will say something, that one might have to suffer a lot and to experience the limitations of the human will, and that it leads not to a dead end, but that it leads to a place of insatiability, that one will always hunger for more, because that human will is a will that was designed, although God gave us free choice, I think that will was designed to be in alliance with a perfect will, a well-ordered, constructed will that is always for our highest good. So we have to reinterpret what constitutes the good in our lives, and that reinterpretation of what constitutes the good is very often going to be at odds with sometimes tragedy that occurs in our lives, or heartbreak. And we might wonder, well, how can that be good for me? But I myself have experienced, I mean, just to take the example of my mother, who went through a very painful, protracted period of cancer. And I kept on thinking, well, what good can come of this? What good can come of this? But paradoxically, her cancer was progressing, I was drawing closer to God. I was having faith. And I'll give you one personal example. 2 weeks before she died, I felt so depleted, so exhausted. And I said to God, God, you're trying to kill me, right? Because that's how I have these loud conversations with God. I think you're trying to kill me. And then when I was praying, I said, give me the strength to just carry on for 2 more weeks. And then after 2 more weeks, I'll ask you for more strength. And at the end of those 2 weeks, he took my mother. So there are two things in place, you know, the mercy and the grace and the love God has for us in feeling our pain. And two, not knowing what can and will arise out of a situation that is very painful for one, watching one's mother die of stage 4 cancer. But out of that painful situation arose a deepening, not a lessening, a deepening of my dependence and my belief and my relationship with God. My prayer life grew a lot more stronger. I won't say paradoxically, I'll just say simultaneously, alongside the decline of my mother's decaying body.
Well, my deepest condolences about your mother. Jason, this book is brand new, but have you gotten any feedback from fellow academics about it? Because I assume that at DePaul, you are sort of in the belly of the beast there, surrounded by left-leaning, atheistic fellow academics and even students, too, for that matter. Does that make you feel alienated at all? And have you gotten any feedback about the book?
I have not gotten any feedback, but I will tell you, my department has been very kind to me in one way, that there are two posters of the book, and I don't know who authorized this. And I know it has to be the work of God, but I've written 5 previous books, and this has never happened before. But there's a poster of my book on 3 separate walls in the department, with a barcode where one can scan one's phone and order the book directly from Amazon. And I looked at that and I said, my God, I was just shocked. As like, I don't see any other faculty members having this, I would call it a privilege or this blessing. Why was my book singled out you know, philosophy department to be pinned up three times on three separate notice boards with a barcode. So I haven't really gotten any feedback from, that's the feedback that I've gotten, which is a silent affirmation in a very, very interesting way.
Wow, that's interesting.
Yeah. Yeah, it's so, I mean, God works in very mysterious ways, right? I mean,
yes, indeed. Wow. That's I was not expecting that answer. Well, it's an extraordinary book, and there is one sentence in it that I would especially like to bring to people's attention because I think it captures what you want your readers to get from this book. At the end of one of your letters to God, you address the reader and you say, quote, "God loves your voice and he wants to hear from you," unquote. I think that's a message and an invitation everybody needs to hear. Would you say that sort that kind of sums up what you would like the reader to get?
Yes, because I think a lot of aspiring believers feel that they're just specks of dust in the universe. And I certainly don't believe. And so because they feel like they're just specks of dust in the universe, that they're irrelevant, they don't speak to God. They don't speak their desires. They don't speak their wishes. They don't speak intimately to God. And so when I say God wants to hear your voice, he wants to hear your cries of lamentations. He wants to hear your despair. He wants to hear, if you're at the point where you are a strong believer, your glorification of him. But to speak your voice, to enter into a dialogue, a deep conversation with God, is one of the richest experiences I think one can have, because it draws one closer to the foundation for your being, not just your existence, but the not just the immutable part of your existence also, but the eternal part of who you are. That is your everlasting soul that will live on, I believe, after you die. And so one has to really speak from not one's chest or one's throat, but from the pit of one's stomach, a cry of desperation, a cry of rejoicing, a cry of praise. But when I say God wants to hear your voice, it's operating against the backdrop of what I think is a benevolent father who wants to hear his children speak to him, communicate to him, and not shut him out. I would like to believe that. I don't know if God feels pain, but I would like to feel that it would warm the heart of God to hear people speak their voice to him in whatever form is most suited to their, you know, to their disposition, to their personality. Whether it's praying silently, whether it's praying aloud, as I often do, I plug out my Alexa because I don't want Amazon hearing my prayers, because they might send an ambulance and send me to the psychiatric ward. So I tend to speak very, as I'm speaking to you, have these loud conversations with God and talk to him and thank him for my existence and thank him for my presence in this world of his. But the other reason too, Mark, I think that God wants to hear our voice is that when we speak to him, we are instructed in a deep way of how to comport ourselves in the world, of how to heal the world, of how to mend the world, whether that be in a, you know, large-scale way or just in a very localized way, smiling at a stranger to suggest that all is not lost, practicing good manners, practicing compassion. There are many ways in which when I think God hears our voices, that we open up the portals of our heart so that we can receive the messages and instructions from God of how to live our lives more deeply, to live our lives more, not just profoundly, but also to live our lives consistently in a manner, again, that is aligned with his will.
Jason, maybe this is jumping the gun a little bit since the book just came out, but do you have another book in the works, even just maybe in the conceptual stages?
Well, I have two books that I'm working on. One is a follow-up book to this, Letters to God, which will be a very, very different book in many respects. It'll still be personal and intimate, but it will be from the perspective of one who's no longer struggling with faith, one who has an unshakable belief in God. So these letters were written as an aspirant, someone who was wavering back and forth between atheism and agnosticism, and then finally found God and signed off at the end with a complete commitment and submission to his will. So I'm working on a follow-up book that will be written from the perspective of what I have learned and what I have discovered. And you talked about an epidemic of loneliness. There's also, you know, it's not an epidemic, but there's a high percentage of suicide in the world. So I'm working on this book in the philosophy of literature called Goddesses of Death, Anne Sexton, Sylvia Plath, and the Moral Meaning of Life. And I'm looking at how poetry and art gives us some purchase on the meaning of life, as seen through these two poets. And when I talk about the meaning of life, it's ultimately going to result back to a return to God. I'm going to show that these many artists suffer from suicidal ideation or suicide. I've experienced that in my life, which I write about, of course, in the book, that the meaning is to be found in God's will and in God's purpose for our lives. And those are the two books that I'm working on right now. I'm going to sort of get back to suffusing my work with, I don't want to say spirituality, but suffusing it with the imprimatur of God's design and God's will for human life. That's what I'll say.
Excellent. Well, I look forward to both of those. How can people keep up with you and your work on the internet?
My Twitter handle is at JasonDHill6. I'm on Facebook as Dr. Jason D. Hill. I have a website that's out of date. It's jasondamianhill.net, so I need to update that. Of course, they can log on to Front Page Magazine and see the articles that I've written there. And, I mean, they just have to Google my name, and I have written a lot of articles for other magazines. Going forward, I think readers might be quite surprised, because, you know, as a newly minted convert, I see the world quite differently now, Mark. I see the world in a different manner, and it's going to color the way I write. And it doesn't mean that I'm going to be proselytizing in my writing. I don't do that, but it does mean that my sensibilities are religious ones. No, they're God-infused. And so the nature of my writing will probably change going forward. People can look at Facebook where I post my articles. I'm on Substack.
Good. Jason Hill, thanks again for joining us at The Right Take. Please keep up the great work, brother.
Thank you, Mark. God bless you.
Listeners, make sure you get a copy of Letters to God from a Former Atheist by Jason D. Hill. It's a powerful testament of faith, and God knows we need more of those. And thank you for joining us. Don't forget to subscribe to The Right Take so you don't miss any of the important conversations we're having here. And remember, if you like what you hear, please leave a positive review. See you next time. The Right Take with Mark Tapson is a project of the David Horowitz Freedom Center and Front Page Magazine. Unauthorized reproduction of this podcast without express written consent is prohibited.